This is KERA News. Today, as part of KERA's Breakthrough Series, a Dallas father's search to understand his son's autism. John Radakis was not looking to launch an investigation, but that's what happened 3 years ago after his son's symptoms changed while taking an antibiotic for strep throat. Today and tonight, Lauren Silverman reports on three clues that led Radakis to question traditional autism research. And a note, we've agreed to change the boy's name to protect his privacy.
Matt could read before he could speak.
I had suspected this when we would read stories and he would turn the pages, but I had just assumed he just knows when it's time to turn the page.
John Radakis is Matt's dad. He's 46, and he spent much of his career as a medical venture capitalist. And as you'll see, Radakis loves to run experiments.
We actually ended up doing this little experiment where we got this like Etch-a-Sketch board. My wife wrote the word run, R-U-N, and held it up and showed it to him, and he ran around the couch.
Run! Run, bear!
And then she wrote the word dance, and he would do a dance.
In a home video, Matt is giggling and running around, a white diaper sticking out of the top of his green striped pajamas. At age two, Matt had this extraordinary ability to read without training. It's called hyperlexia, and usually it's associated with autism.
But at the time, our son was happy, he was engaged, he was loving. And so we thought, well, maybe he's just one of those super rare hyperlexics that's not also autistic.
Not long after, Radakis and his wife, Christy, noticed a serious change.
Within the course of a month, he basically stopped making eye contact. He became quite rigid, meaning sort of an insistence on sameness. And when things didn't go the way he wanted, you know, he would throw fits and temper tantrums.
Matt, who's now five, was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. One in 68 children has it. Symptoms vary greatly among kids. Classic features are impaired communication, poor social engagement, and repetitive behavior. Now, before we go on with the story, a warning. Autism is one of the most divisive medical conditions there is. It separates scientists from scientists and parents from parents because after decades of research, we still don't know what causes it. And when you don't know the cause of a disorder, you don't know how to treat it. You don't know how to help kids like Matt. As he plants some vegetables in the backyard one afternoon, Matt gets distracted by the image on the back of a seed packet. It's a drawing of the United States.
What's that state?
Montana.
And that one?
California.
And this one?
Maine.
He's an adorable five-year-old, and he's different. He's already a math whiz and can recite state capitals with ease. There are also bouts of screaming and crying impossible to soothe. He has trouble socializing or breaking routine. Even the idea of me sitting down with him at lunch is upsetting.
Can I sit with you?
No.
No? Can I stand?
No. No.
So what's behind behaviors like this? We don't know. Dr. Wendy Chung says that's why autism theories have flourished.
So there's been many waves of popular thinking about what's caused autism. Everything from problems or bad parenting to vaccines to, you know, a shift in terms of thinking that it's genes playing a large role.
Chung directs clinical research at one of the country's major autism research programs, the Simons Foundation in New York. The conventional view of autism is that it's mostly a genetic disorder. It's something kids inherit and are born with. Their brains are hardwired differently. Radakis and his wife accepted that idea, and they did what most parents do: therapy. Speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy. Matt had dozens of hours each week. Then they started to question the conventional view of autism. They began to notice their son's symptoms changed depending on environmental factors, like what he ate, what medicines he took. Really, there were three clues that led Radakis to believe his son could get better. Clues that parents and researchers are trying to explain. Clue number one, the fever effect.
We observed that when our son would have a fever, we would notice these kind of transient improvements in his speech and his mood and in his eye contact. And it was noticeable enough that I went to the medical literature to see if there was anything about this, and sure enough, there was.
Now, most parents don't spend their free time studying publications like The Lancet or the New England Journal of Medicine. John Rodakis is not most parents. He's trained as a molecular biologist and wedded to his hardcore scientific roots. In the living room of his Dallas home, Rodakis flips open a binder filled with the latest publications on autism research. He's driven by data, and he keeps track of his son obsessively.
I track all of his features, his rigidity, how agreeable he is, his happiness, his energy level, his spaciness. And what I then do is I export all of this out to Excel, and I create basically charts and graphs.
So, how far back does this go?
I don't even know, like pretty much since his diagnosis.
Which brings us back to that first clue. When Matt was 2.5, this is after his parents suspected he was autistic, he came down with a mild fever. What's strange is that instead of being more lethargic, he was more agreeable, more talkative, and attentive than usual. Curious, Rodakis reached out to an expert, a pediatric neurologist named Andrew Zimmerman. This is a guy who's cared for thousands of autistic patients, published more than 70 peer-reviewed papers, and served as director of medical research at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore. Zimmerman has a name for this change in behavior among kids with autism. He calls it the fever effect.
If you ask people coming into an autism clinic if they've ever seen this, about 20 to 30% of families will spontaneously tell you that.
Enough parents told Zimmerman about this fever effect that in 2007, his team evaluated 30 kids with autism from age 2 to 18 during and after a fever. And the results? Fewer autistic-like behaviors for those kids with fever compared to controls. This was compelling, but it was a small study, and no one was about to go around advocating giving kids with autism fevers. So Zimmerman and colleagues at Johns Hopkins planned a follow-up without the high temperature. They isolated a molecule that mimics the fever effect. It's called sulforaphane, and it's in vegetables like broccoli and Brussels sprouts. Using that molecule, they did a double-blind study.
We found that, in fact, sulforaphane improved 2/3 of the young men who received the drug compared to those on placebos.
So how might a fever and a molecule found in broccoli reduce autism symptoms? Here's how Zimmerman explains it. Along with the bad stuff, fever causes cells to produce more energy, to be more active. He thinks that might help troubled cells ramp up production and work properly. There's a big idea here, the idea that there are ways to improve autism symptoms without altering genes. For Dad John Rodakis, the fever study provided hope. But it took two more clues to convince him. It would take more than conventional research to understand kids like Matt. Lauren Silverman, KERA News.
This morning on KERA, we heard the first part of a story about autism, of how one dad's search to understand the disorder led him down a rabbit hole of research into new theories of what causes autism and how to treat it. KERA's Lauren Silverman takes us back to the journey of Dallas dad John Rodakis.
Clue number two came in the form of pills. We'll call it the antibiotic effect.
So it was Thanksgiving 2012, and, you know, we did what a lot of American families do, go to grandma's house.
It was supposed to be a quiet holiday. Then Matt and his little sister got strep throat. Both were prescribed antibiotics, a 10-day course of amoxicillin. On day 4, something changed with Matt. He's often low energy, lethargic. On that day, he was running around.
More importantly, he was happy and smiling and making eye contact and stringing words together in ways that he never had before.
Each day, his son seemed to get better, making more eye contact, speaking more articulately.
You know, autism can sometimes put kids in a fog. And he was looking into my eyes and he was happy. And he was, it's like he was telling me, I'm here, talk to me, play with me.
Then, on day 6...
I hear a tricycle behind me, and I whip around, and I see my son riding that tricycle around like a normal little 3.5-year-old. And you might say, well, what's so remarkable about that? Well, up until that day, he had never so much as been able to push the pedal enough on that tricycle to move it forward.
With clue number one, the fever effect, they'd seen mild improvements. This was different.
It's like the veil of autism just was lifted magically.
Did he imagine it? Not necessarily.
So many children with autism, yeah, have behavior changes with antibiotics, both positive and negative.
That's Dr. Richard Fry. He's a pediatric neurologist and director of research at Arkansas Children's Hospital Autism Center. Fry often hears from parents who report a kind of antibiotic effect.
One of the issues with somebody saying, oh, I gave my child this antibiotic and they got better, is that they're giving the antibiotic for a reason. The child is sick, so the child may have a fever, may have other types of inflammatory and immune processes going on. So it's important for any type of treatment to make sure that it's done systematically.
The only scientific study that's looked specifically at antibiotics and autism is one from the late 90s, published in the Journal of Child Neurology. It was meant to be a pilot study, but raising money for a follow-up proved too difficult. 10 boys with autism were given the antibiotic vancomycin. The results were shocking. 8 of the 10 young men had noticeable improvements in their behavior.
They would now look at people that spoke to them. They would let their mother kiss them. Things that just wouldn't happen before.
Dr. Sidney Feingold did that study. Now, 93, he's been researching antibiotics for half a century. His trial with vancomycin and autism was controversial.
Well, we had trouble getting it published, actually, because the journals were reluctant to believe that this actually happened. So,
when Feingold brings it up at meetings, some pediatricians still slough it off. Others have embraced the idea that antibiotics can influence autism symptoms. How? By affecting the gut. Which brings us to clue number 3 for Dallas dad John Rodakis. Remember, there was the fever effect, the antibiotic effect, and now the food factor. The food we eat, like the antibiotics we take, influence the microorganisms that live in our gut. After Rodakis saw the change from the strep throat medicine, he decided to try changing his son's diet.
So the first thing that we tried was we took gluten out of his diet, and we didn't really see any improvements. Later, we tried taking dairy out of his diet, and within about 3 days, we saw pretty dramatic improvements in speech and in eye contact.
That was it. Diet was clue number 3.
You know, each one of those was kind of a chink in that armor where finally I came to the conclusion that I said, you know, at least for my kid, there's more going on than simply genetics.
No, John Rodakis doesn't believe vaccines cause autism or that antibiotics can cure it. His thinking reflects a larger shift in autism research, a shift away from genetics as the sole explanation for autism towards a complex interaction between environment and genes. Again, Dr. Fry.
I think there's been the promise that genetics is going to, you know, tell us so much about medical diseases. If you look at heart disease, diabetes and such, there's no gene. You know, there's no diabetes gene. Really. But what we do know is that there's a big influence between susceptibility factors and environment.
Think about it. Your genes may predispose you to heart disease. Really, though, your lifestyle, what you eat, those factors often determine if you'll actually get heart disease. An emerging idea for what's behind some cases of autism isn't that different. The thinking goes what we put in our stomach, pills, pizza, carrots, alter the bacteria that live in and on us. And that alters our behavior. So when Dallas dad John Rodakis noticed those changes in his son, he offered to send a fecal sample to a microbial biologist in Canada.
That's a funny request. You get that a lot, though.
I do. Believe it or not, I do.
That's Emma Allen Vercoe. She studies the communities of bacteria, called microbiota, that live in our guts. Vercoe likes to think of the microbiota in our gut as a rainforest.
And the beauty of a rainforest ecosystem is that it's a very stable ecosystem. And the stability comes from the fact that this is a very diverse ecosystem. So there's many, many, many different species that are all acting to give a net effect, if you like, of the output of the ecosystem.
Virkou says when we change our diet, like John Rodakis did with his son, or take antibiotics, like strep throat medication, it can clear-cut swaths of that rainforest, changing the entire ecosystem.
And I think what's really exciting in this whole field is that we've completely overlooked until now the fact that microbes and humans talk to each other. In terms of the gut microbiota, there are specific pathways that relay information from the microbes in the gut to the brain and actually have effects on behavior and mood. And all of that's been completely overlooked.
See, a major focus in research in autism has been on finding the underlying genetic causes, with less emphasis on potential environmental triggers. John Rodakis is trying to change that on a personal and international level.
The ants.
In the backyard, Rodakis is helping his son study ants.
Just one ant.
On the larger level, he's helping scientists study autism. Last year, this former venture capitalist trained in microbiology started a nonprofit. The goal? Raise money to back scientifically grounded research that doesn't fit with conventional wisdom.
And in particular, we favor research that treats these phenomenon and these observations as clues as to what may be going on.
Clues not always visible through a traditional research lens, but that often come into focus through the eyes of a parent. Lauren Silverman, KERA News.